Perfect. Absolutely perfect. That was beautiful. Thank you, Kathy. That could not, your song choices today, the reading, could not have been any better for the message that I'm about to deliver. Good morning. I welcome you yet again to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living. I'm Reverend Karen Rice, and I am the spiritual leader of this community, and it's such an important effort in my life. I mean, my entire purpose for being has you know, been to be able to arrive at this time in my life where I can stand here and follow the words of a song that I feel such passion for and have for so long since I was a rebellious teenager. Oh, wait, I'm still rebellious. But here's the clincher for me that's really got me touched at this moment, and that is that I have been away. I went to San Diego to a class, a very unusual experience. It was a class for ministers and ministerial students, and they were saying that they hoped that all the ministers in our movement will be able to eventually take this class. It was a class called Reimagining Relevance, and it was about just what you said. When you hit that line in the song, imagine there's no religion. Well, the world is headed in an interesting direction right now, and though I don't believe we will ever have no religion, I actually have come home even more rejuvenated and uplifted for the future of religion. It's just not going to look the way it has looked. And so what can we do to stay relevant? What can we do to keep imagining? Every time I hear that line in that song that says, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And every time I have heard that song and sung that line, I feel it even more powerfully within me, that I know I am not the only one. The title of my message today is Immortal Longings, and I was wondering, it's not exactly the direction I was going in the talk, but when you chose that song, Kathy, I was wondering if that isn't really what that longing is. So what I want to talk about today is indeed something within us. I did say immortal and not immoral, right? One time I made a big mistake a lot of years ago, and it was a public thing, and it was a very fundamental religion, and I was sharing a comment over a microphone and said that Jesus was immoral. And I have never recovered from that. I just like passed through my mind. I hadn't thought about it all morning. I've been rehearsing. Never even crossed my mind until I just said, wait, did you say it properly? But you guys could hang with that here. I think you guys could take that kind of slip of, that kind of little accident would just flow. You'd laugh, I'd laugh, and it'd be fine, right? But at any rate, there is this gorgeous way I want to speak to something within us that is a divine longing. And Ernest Holmes, who is the founder of this philosophy, the science of mind, we've been around a long time. We used to be religious science, and now we go by Centers for Spiritual Living is our new, fairly new. How long, Sue, do you think? I said almost 10 years. We changed our name maybe 10 years ago. People, you think about that? And what we're trying to do is make a world that works for everyone. We're trying to do our part, and we have never been very good at being religious. And yet I think many of us are. We bring that gorgeous history of knowing how to be religious and answering that divine call within us in our own spiritual way. So we do it in all kinds of ways. And what we do beautifully in this sanctuary is we join together and we have an individual experience, knowing that everybody else is having their unique individual experience as well, and it may be different than ours, and yet all of that is okay. So any way that we enhance the well-being of our own life, in my opinion, any way we enhance the well-being of our own life, we have enhanced the well-being of this planet. And so I do my part every week to pull together something that will be hopefully a little bit uplifting and inspiring, and in other ways I sort of hope to nudge you to make you a little uncomfortable so you can see those areas where you too can grow in a personal way. But we always attempt to do that without shaming you. There's been enough shame in the world, and we now step forward in this brand new way of addressing those divine longings within us. As I was preparing the message, I decided that in the most simple way, for me, what I believe that divine longing is I would say it's connection. And I believe that when we recognize that gorgeous way we are created to have that longing for connection, and sometimes we just think it's fellowship, it's a community, a connection with each other, but really all of that takes us to that deeper truth that our longing is that craving to know that we are united with that one creator of all things, that there is that power and that presence in the universe that we can really never be separated from, and yet the whole point of life is that we get busy being alive and doing the things that we are called to do, and so we forget. And in our forgetfulness, we have an experience that is sometimes referred to as separation. And I think it's really easy in these bodies to feel disconnected from each other or separate from each other. And so as we move through our life, looking for ways to meet together, to create community in all kinds of ways, and we work at those things, we have a call to notice that maybe we desire to be more compassionate or kinder or just to be more loving in maybe even our own families. And so whatever little way we are stirred by that divine longing, that immortal longing to be reconnected, whatever that stirring is, it has to be a good, beautiful invitation. Because when Holmes used that term immortal longing, he's talking about that which can never die, that which can never cease to be. So that craving or yearning or longing within us will always, always be there. And that's why some of us are really comfortable saying we're seekers, even though if you study this enough, you'll eventually come back circle to go, hey, there's nothing to be sought, it's already here, and all of that. But nonetheless, we're called or motivated by that something bigger than we are that we can't quite wrap our minds around. So I want to just tell you that while I was attending this class, we were really looking at what it means to reimagine our relevance as a spiritual teaching. And all of the people that they brought in, all of the instructors or wise authorities from around the country that they brought in via technology. So we had this big screen, and it was like, it was really well done. I got to tell you, it was really like having them right in the room. It wasn't like FaceTime or, you know, where sometimes there's a little, you know that it's technology. This was like really having them right there. It was really good. I think it was Zoom. We want to know that. But they did a really good job of it. And so all of the people that spoke to us were amazing people who were not connected to our movement in any way. So the teacher of the class was Lola Wright from the big CSL center in Chicago called Bodie. Chicago CSL, also known as Bodie, used to be Mark Anthony Lord. He is the founder of that community. So this gorgeous woman who is right at the top end of the millennials, so she's young, I think she was 36 years old, has a bunch of kids, and including some teenagers. She has a his and ours blended family. And she comes with this great wisdom. She's a wonderful religious science background, a minister, and she's raising these children who are saying that they're atheists or they're just not sure what they believe, and she's really okay with that, which I think is a beautiful thing for us to get into a position where if we're going to honor all paths, we have to not freak out if our kids want to be atheists or our grandkids don't want anything to do with spirituality. We need to be relevant, and the only way to do that is to totally throw out everything we have believed that church or spiritual training is about and reapproach it. So these great experts from around the country that have me so excited right now, I'm having trouble sleeping. I'm so excited about all the stuff we've discussed. But there was this one woman who is also young, I think she was 35, a progressive female Jewish rabbi in progressive Judaism. There were these, and you know what was thrilling for me is I've been doing this work, I've been doing this research and studying this stuff and digging in, and some of the speakers they brought in were people I have been reading about. So for me, and plus I'm a little bit of a groupie, you know, so for me it was like, oh, I know those names, and I read that study, and I know that work, and it was like, it just for me was this fabulous validation from the universe that I am on track for where I should be as a minister. So, you know, lots of exciting things happen there, and I'm not going to share most of it with you. But it has created something in me that is excited about our future. Now, if you come all the time, we have a lot of new people today. So for those of you who have not heard me say this 100 times already, I have this great optimism that this philosophy and all the other teachings in the broader idea of New Thought, that we really are prime. We are poised in this gorgeous place. We're already out there on the fringes. You know, we're not very orthodox in anything, really. And so, and because we have an investment in being open-minded and accepting and inclusive, which is the nature of this teaching, based on the way that the founder, Ernest Holmes, did all of his study of all the world's religions and spiritual traditions and psychology as it came about, and great works of literature and all of that. He took it all in, and what I see is that he was really giving us this great preparatory experience for what the world would look like now. Because it's not just the kids in the U.S. It's not just the millennials. There is actually a new saying. It's SBNR. Anybody know what SBNR stands for? If you don't, you will be hearing it more and more. It is that idea that you can be spiritual but not religious. SBNR, spiritual but not religious. And that's the direction that most of our young people are going. Now, that is not to say they are not, I would use the term comfortably, I would say they're pretty God-centered in their spiritual approach, but they don't all use that term God. So, for instance, my teacher said that her atheist daughter, who's 17 years old, loves to go to a mainstream fundamental church because on Wednesday nights, all the kids her age get together and they don't do anything to do with church. They do artwork or they play games together, they listen to music, and once a month they have an away from church service activity. And her atheist daughter, who was likely raised in this philosophy, is fed by having that community with people her age who are clearly spiritual, even though they are religious, and they get to go out and do service in the world. And that's one of the things we're seeing sharply in this millennial generation is it's just not going to be church in the way it's been. They absolutely don't want to be lectured at. They want to talk. They want to sit and have conversation. And the interesting thing for me is the more I study the millennials, the more I say, well, we were just the pre-millennials. I mean, so much of what describes them describes us. When we do, every fall, when I pass out a survey and I look to collect information from you, you say those same things. And so we're all looking for a way. We all have that divine longing for that sense of connection, but we have to do it in our own unique way. I don't always do it like this, you know. There are certain Thursdays where I wear different clothes and hang out at Westgate with all my Harley friends. And that's a whole, I know, right? So, you know, so it, bring it on. It's got to be in the way that you are stirred, in the way that you are called. And notice it can still be a spiritual community, because what is spiritual community? You know, we say often, well, I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. And we kind of feel, we laugh, you know, like we turn that around as if it's all original. But it's what it is. You cannot avoid that eternal truth of who you are in there. So what we know is that religion has traditionally, for thousands of years, religion has served the purpose to explain to people how to be spiritual. I mean, that would be kind of the short version. But what religion is it creates a cosmology for a group of people who have similar cultural values. So we have religions. You'll notice that there are predominant religions in different regions of around the world. And because Christianity is sort of the predominant, or has been the predominant religion in the West, what we see is that there is a reverence for holy scriptures, right? And in other regions of the world, there are other sacred works. And our founder, Dr. Ernest Holmes, studied all of that to seek, at first just for himself, he didn't intend to start something, but to seek that which is similar, that which we all share. So you might say a cosmology then is sort of a people's story. Religion helps us to create a story around life as we see it. So we have always hungered to kind of understand our place in the world, right? We want to have a better understanding of the meaning of life, of how to understand where we stand in the cosmos or the universe, and to have answers to, like, well, how did this all begin? You know, so everybody has a creation story, and, well, what's next? So we get heaven and hell and reincarnation, and we get all these other juicy topics to dialogue about together in our experience of chatting about these things. And then what about the creator? You know, what is there some supreme intelligence in the universe? And so every religion creates their own story around all of this stuff in order to explain those difficult to answer questions. What we notice, if you study world religions, is that there are a lot of stories that overlap, that a whole bunch of those stories are not unique to any one faith. So there are variations of the creation story, and there are other faiths other than Christianity. Christianity doesn't solely own the flood story, you know, about the earth getting flooded. And even the idea of the virgin birth is not unique to Christianity. So there's a lot of mythology that gets melded in because it's about a culture, a way a people have evolved through time. And in order to make sense of our life, all you've got is your own story, right? So we're all looking for that sort of understanding. And I would say that, in my opinion, which everybody knows is, you know, I wrote my blog last week, and I wrote, in my jubilant opinion, and I thought, oh, that's such a good word. You know, if you're going to have an opinion, and hey, whether you think you're opinionated or not, you are, and why not let it be jubilant? You know, be on fire, shout it out, love it. So in my jubilant opinion, religion tries to explain then about the sacred stuff. And spirituality is that which gives us the experience of having that oneness with that which is sacred. So I think that the highest service any religion could offer any of us would be to teach people to be open to that oneness with the divine, to pay attention to that divine longing, that immortal longing within. In our Declaration of Principles, which is about as much theology as we claim, although we do have a really, I think we have a unique approach to life. We are something. We're not nothing. We are something. And it's well thought out. I also have to say that. And it appeals to us because we do tend to attract people that appreciate reasoning and sort of an intellectual way to dive into spiritual understandings. But in our Declaration of Principles, which Ernest Holmes wrote, and we have modified slightly, we call them our what we believe statements, we say this: anyone can become a revealer of truth who lives in close contact with the indwelling God. Anyone can reveal truth, and in fact, the only way truth can be revealed in your own life is through you. So we, amen, that's right. Whoa, football must be over. Welcome home, Cheryl. Nice to get those little amens in the dark out from the back there. So the only way we can have any truth revealed to us is through our own inquiry. And that implies to me that once in a while, I have to not know it all, but I have to be in that place of that spirit of inquiry. So we come to, in Science of Mind communities, in centers for spiritual living all over the world, we gather together and we do it in all kinds of different ways. You will probably find you do it in the way that your minister prefers. The way your minister likes is probably the way you're going to see it. And what we do is we create a place for the individual to have an experience of something greater. Just to remember there's something more. And so we have, we come because we have our own form of worship. You know, you come and you get an intellectual message, but it's sandwiched between prayer and prayer, right? And we have music, we have voice and song, and sometimes opportunity to sing, and then we come for fellowship, and that is the way we define worship inside a CSL center. Now, if we look at some of the rich history connected to religions, I'd like to look at Judaism, because it's ancient and we can understand it, because if you've ever been Christian, which many here have, if you've ever had or consider yourself Christian even now, then you have a rich relationship, it's likely, with Scripture. And because Judaism, by the way, I always get tickled that we, as a Christian, as an old fundamentalist, I might say the Old Testament, but I want you to realize that from a Jewish perspective, there is no Old Testament. It just is the Bible. And so there are these rich stories. Now, lots of us get really put off by the drama in the Old Testament and that idea of such a judgmental God, Jehovah, sitting up on a cloud somewhere, judging everybody and doing things to, you know, turning people to salt and destroying and all that stuff. But if you take a step back from the parts that you don't like, and you look at not just the historical view of Judaism, of the Hebrew people, what you see is that the history is rich and real and visceral. You know, there was a period of enslavement, and then after enslavement, what happens? Liberation. See, if we look at it as the whole, we can see that one thing leads to the other in the same way that we teach what we teach here, that there's something rich and beautiful in the stories that come from different cosmologies. There's a way in which the Hebrew people experienced that idea of wandering. But what happens in that story of wandering? We learn about survival, right? And eventually we learn that you do arrive at the next destination. And some of these stories are repeated in different ways in that same part of the Bible. And so we see there becomes a theme, and then it's easy to say, well, let's look at the God that the Jewish or the Hebrew people have believed in. And what we can see, if you're open-minded enough, you can see that there is this idea of a God that's extremely powerful, that does have the elements of love, even along with all the judgment, which was in the story as a source of protection, that if we look at the wandering and the idea of that they had manna every day fresh to eat, and they could only pick enough to last for one day except on the Sabbath, and then there miraculously would be enough for 2 days, as the story goes, we see in their story this rich view of God as the provider, the sustenance. You know, so we can see even a theme of abundance as we look at the way they have that idea of being cared for in their story, and that we have a God of power and protection. These are really beautiful elements that are in all stories. you know, go to the movies and look for that line of, that typical line of myth or story in any movie that you see, and we begin to see that which is similar for all of us. Because in our own stories, in our own lives, we have felt enslaved at times, only to become liberated later. We have felt like we are lost and we are wandering, only to see that we are provided for and that we eventually arrive at a destination that maybe we didn't even see coming. And so there are elements of these stories that are useful for all of us, and that's why we see them repeated through mythology. But all of it is about us trying to make sense of our own life, of our own story. And the beautiful thing we supplement here, is that you are still co-creating your own story. So you get to add characters and events and meaning to the things that you go through. And sometimes down the road, the meaning will change. Something that happened a long time ago and that you used to hold as a really difficult thing becomes something precious to you and an important part of your own growth and an important part of your own story. Now, Thomas Troward is a fabulous metaphysician, sort of a contemporary of Ernest Holmes, a little before Holmes he lived, but he also said it's important to look at our story, but to pay attention to the story that you're writing so that you don't have a lot of useless suffering in that story. And, you know, we're looking at that as we're joining other CSL centers and talking about creating a world that works for everyone. One of the themes for this month, the month of January, was like, yeah, the necessity for suffering is over. Can we please let it go? Can we start to look at our life not so much from a victim's perspective, but be empowered by the tools that we teach on these spiritual paths? So Thomas Troward said, we seem to believe in some way, in some form of self-starvation, as if it is necessary for us to suffer in order to have good works. And, you know, and that kind of fits with a little bit of the Protestant work ethic, I was thinking, is in the way that I remember being raised and sort of what seems to be ingrained. So what part of all of this shows up in your own life, and in what part do you desire to change? Because I want to tell you something. If you've got suffering in your life, and if you've got suffering for a period of time, maybe you're a little attached to the suffering and you haven't realized that yet. Now, I know nobody wants to suffer, you know. Nobody wants any of that. But the problem with being in suffering, especially over a prolonged period of time, and you can define suffering any way you like, but the problem with it is that when you are suffering, Thomas Troward says, you are in direct opposition to God. Because when we are suffering, we are allowing ourselves to just kind of live in this murky atmosphere of negativity, of pain, and of sorrow, and whatever it is. So it's not that we don't suffer. You know me, I'm really a fan of the dark side. You know, I don't think we get to avoid it, that we will all have a dark night of the soul. But it doesn't have to be the story that holds you down and weighs you down. It is in direct opposition to God, because we are missing that whole point in the way that we are inherently made, with this ability to tap into that indwelling power and use it for our good, to align ourselves to it, to make new choices, and to change our very lives. So there's all of that. I'm going to move quickly ahead and skip all of that other stuff I was going to say. Ooh, I'm having fun today. So I wanted to make one more comment, and I heard this from, well, no, I didn't. I heard, I've been thinking about this for quite a while. Some of you may have even heard me in conversation, because I've been kind of talking about it out loud, and that is, when I look at the Jewish faith, one of the things I greatly admire is the way that young students, and rabbis will sit down and argue together, right? So there's this idea of sitting at a table face to face, and they maybe have their sacred books. In fact, they're in a great room that looks like a big, wonderful library, and they have their favorite teachers that they quote and favorite sacred readings, and they're always exploring and contemplating, and then they sit down and they have these meaty discussions with each other. Sue Witter and I do this sometimes. Oh, I probably shouldn't. I was going to say a naughty word there for a minute. But you can read my thought balloon. And but sometimes you get and you're going, no, it's not that way. It's not like that. You know the way I see it is? And you just get really excited. And so there's this great, sometimes intense debate where you are not in agreement. Notice that that happens, and that you can still have a friendship, have a love, have a mutual respect for each other. And I was just thinking, the more I think about this, you know, the students and the rabbis don't argue with each other to prove that they're right or to feel good about themselves or to put somebody else down. They argue about spiritual truths so they can sharpen their own understanding of spiritual matters, right? So it's not like two rabbis are sitting down. It sounded like a joke, didn't it? Two rabbis are sitting down together, and they're, and one of them is going to get angry or get their feelings hurt and leave. It's not like that, because the two rabbis are not looking for agreement. They're looking to deepen in what they believe. Now, if you take that, hang with me just a minute, but if you take that a tiny step further and you begin to realize that we are all different because we have different cosmologies, we have different family experiences, we have lived different lives, so we have our very own unique point of view that's not going to be like another person's point of view on the planet. Even your siblings do not remember. My children could not have had the same two parents. They just have such different views of how they were raised and what happened when they were being raised, right? That's because we have different points of view. And I notice sometimes when I'm teaching or I'm sitting in the conversation circle, Reverend Cheryl, you know, that's another person you can go head-to-head with. Whew, that we have fun. What happens is sometimes people will speak, and there, maybe you even had this delicious spiritual experience and you just want to share it with somebody else, but then somebody goes, but no, that's not quite how it is. You know, the way it is for me is like this. And it's so tempting to feel not heard or misunderstood or just like, these people just don't get me. So what is that? That is when we separate ourselves. Nobody can make you feel that way. That's inside of you. That's the reason we come together, is so that we can beautifully heal that stuff. So I think that if we can have discussions and not be afraid because really it's not kind to just always agree when you really don't agree, right? And I'm also not saying you have to argue, but I'm saying I think there is another way for us to come together where we can really begin to practice honoring our differences. Doesn't that sound exciting? So it is about listening, but I'm thinking, because if we're going to reimagine relevance in every way, I'm thinking there are some great examples out there of the way scholarly people may argue a point, and they may even, it may get heated, and they may even really want to be right in what they do, but there's a way that they then leave that conversation either being more sure of what they believe already or more curious and open-minded about something they haven't figured out yet. And that's what I think we can do. That's what I think the invitation is. And I think that the whole point is about the individual invitation to deepening, to connecting with God, and to understanding this stuff in a way that is uniquely yours to claim and to own, and that which will feed you. Because I'll tell you something, no two people are here for the same purpose. And so what I need out of the lesson is going to be completely different than what anybody else needs out of the lesson. And that is going to just be a beautiful logarithmic equation that grows and grows. Rumi, the most amazing Rumi, said, one of my favorite Rumi quotes, there are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. And I would say there are thousands upon thousands of ways of viewing what God is, or what you want to call that which seems to be that infinite intelligence in your life. And I think that not only is it immortal, in other words, enduring and timeless and dateless and perpetual, but it is vast and infinite in ways we can't even begin to imagine. So I just invite you to look at your own story, to look for the treasure in your story and the way it has served as a map, and look for the parts of your life that serve you and the parts that no longer serve you, and just recognize that we are all in choice, and that immortal longing within us is a divine call, and no one will hear it quite the way you hear it. And yet everyone has the opportunity to hear their own perfect message. And so as we just take a moment to allow all of these ideas, the tiny little seeds of possibility that may have been planted this morning, let's just anchor these ideas in prayer. And each person here is invited to reimagine the relevance of his or her own life.